Tired of sound bites from artists promoting their latest movies, music, and literature? Do you want to hear frank discussions about pop culture without the bullshit PR pitches from high-priced spin doctors? Then you want to stay tuned to The Culture Catch. Joining me today on The Culture Catch is mega successful writer, director David Koepp. He's adapted screenplays and written screenplays for some of the biggest movies over the past 10 years, including Mission Impossible, Jurassic Park 1 and 2, Spider-Man, War of the Worlds, which will probably be released by the time listeners hear this. And this fall, Zathura, is that the correct?
That is.
Directed by Jon Favreau. You've worked with Spielberg, De Palma, David Fincher. Yes, can't forget Panic Room with Jodie Foster, great movie.
Right.
As well as your own features that you've written and directed, Stir of Echoes with Kevin Bacon, and Secret Window last year with Johnny Depp. And this I haven't seen, but I have to find this one, this indie feature Suspicious, which was a short.
Yeah.
With Janine Garofalo.
It was as indie as they come in that I paid for it myself. You don't get any more indie than that. You know, no distribution and you paid for it yourself.
That's, really? Were you nominated for an Academy Award?
Sadly, no.
Wow.
I was misunderstood by the theatrical community.
Is this something you can find? Can it be downloaded from someplace?
No. Don't download. Well, actually, no, you can't. It's I have a videotape, and I can drop one off next time I go out.
All right, we'll get it posted on the website and maybe charge subscription rates.
Yeah, there you go. It's very fun. It's a lot of fun. I like that short film. Short films are great because they're all about the punchline. So you can. It's 12 minutes long, and short films have no second act. They're all first and third act. It's all set up and payoff, which is a lot of fun, and you're out, and you can still have time to go have dinner.
What was the whole point of doing this? Was this something you've written in film school or something? Or
it was I did it in 96, I think, because I wanted to direct.
Right.
And I'd written some stuff, but I'd never directed anything. So I thought I wrote the script I wanted to direct, and then I directed this short film to show with it to say, look, I can do it. It's not that hard. Let me do it. So that was why. So I just came up with some money. But what was amazing is that it's only 10 years later. And back then when you made a film, you know, if you wanted to make a nice looking film, you had to go out and find 50 grand somewhere and buy film and, you know, have all the big trucks and, you know, really cough up. And now, you know, digital filmmaking's come so far, you can make a great looking film for about $600 and, you know, you don't need that kind of capital, which is a great democratizing influence on movie making.
And that's encouraging for any young writers and directors who are out there. I mean, the Macintosh platform, you know, even the PC with Avid and Pro Tools, like we're running this show, just completely levels the playing field. And still, at the end of the day, you need a good story.
Yeah.
And the vision, it's hard to put a film together, though, still.
Yeah, but what you don't have is the giant obstacles that don't seem fair anymore. It used to be that writing was the only area of filmmaking where you didn't need anybody's permission to do it. You know, you could just... If you had paper and you had some ideas, you were fine. But now directing's the same way, which is great because the only way to learn how to direct is to do it. You can't. Studying it really doesn't do any good. You just have to pick up a camera and start trying to do it.
Now, you went to film school. Did you study directing or were you primarily just focused on writing? Did you do a student film?
I was primarily focused on writing, but by choice and in my own time. I did a couple films because I went to UCLA and you study a little bit of everything. So even if you don't want to do that aspect of movie making in your career, you still need to learn about it. So I did a couple films, but I liked writing a lot, mostly because I liked the hours and the lifestyle. And it just also seemed possible. I saw a route to breaking in through writing, but I couldn't figure out how to break in through directing.
Right. Well, and Apartment Zero, was that written in film school or after you got out of film school?
That was just after. I was working as an unpaid intern for this guy, Maury Eisenman, who was a producer's rep. I worked out of his kitchen, and then after like a year, we represented people with low-budget films looking for U.S. distributors, or sometimes we represented foreign distributors who looking for B and C movie titles. We used to buy porn for this one guy in Australia, you know, it was like anything to pay the rent.
The perks of the job as an intern, man.
Yeah, exactly. The low point of the job was when he asked me to transfer, make some copies of this tape he had and send them to some friends of his. And then he left, and I popped it in, and I was starting to copy it, and it was a shot of his living room. I was like, well, this is weird. And then he ran on camera naked with a hard on. And I was like, oh, no. You know, and then the tape cut. And there were two hookers at the door, and I was like, oh, God, this is the movie business. I'm really entering through the ass. So I worked for him for free for about a year. I'm not sure why, but, you know, and then he bumped me up to $150 a week. But when he couldn't pay me, sometimes he'd pay me in pot if he didn't have any money. So, you know, because he was a surfer and had a lot of it. But then it turned out to be a very good thing because I met Martin Donovan, not the actor Martin Donovan, another Martin Donovan who's a director, and he had this idea. He's Argentinian, and he had this idea for a movie, but he needed an American writer to work with. So we wrote Apartment Zero, and then Maury helped us raise $700,000 from selling off the foreign video rights and then banking the contract. And
wow.
So, you know, we got a movie made.
And you had a critically successful movie. It got pretty fair reviews, as I recall.
It did. It got good reviews, and it did really well at some festivals. And it had a U.S. release, you know, which was okay. But it kind of became a cult movie among certain people.
Right,
you know,
right.
Which I guess is what cult is defined by.
What's been your, you know, this is a broad stroke question. What's been your favorite project start to finish? I know it's tough for a writer because you have all of these people pulling on you, the director, the producers, the studio people. What pops into your mind when I say, what's been your favorite project start to finish?
A couple of them were really uniquely good experiences. Stir of Echoes probably was the best because I wrote it and then I directed it, and I was really happy with the way it turned out. And the people I worked with all along were really good. As a writer, though, two of them were... I'm just looking for coherence, you know, in who I work with. Can I just work with the same person all the time and not be fucked with by seven people, you know? Like, Spider-Man was a great... I mean, the end result was great, but the process was sheer torture. It was... You know, just horrible. I had seven people to please, none of whom ever agreed with each other.
Right.
You know, they kept firing me and rehiring me. You know, so I was like, I had battered wife syndrome. You know, they'd beat me, and then I'd slink away, and then they'd call up and say, "We're sorry about that, but you know, you had it coming." And I was like, "Yeah, I know. Just rehire me." And then they'd hire me back. It was very sick.
We had an earlier conversation. You said that. One of the reasons you were involved minorly with Spider-Man 2, but that was such a bad taste in your mouth.
I did a first draft
right.
of it. I didn't want to because it had been a very bad experience, and I thought it was a bad experience. We got lucky. The movie turned out great. Let's leave it at that. But I had another project at the studio, which turned out to be Secret Window, that I wanted to direct.
Right.
And the head of the studio was convinced that they really needed me to do a draft. Of Spider-Man 2, so she kind of said, well, you know, we can't really concentrate on Secret Window unless we know Spider-Man 2's in good shape. So I got the hint. So I did a draft, and then she fired me. I was like, wow, I fell for it again. I'm Charlie Brown with a football.
Even with the success of Spider-Man, they fired you.
Yeah. I didn't make it easy on them. I like, refused to talk to certain people, like the producer, and... I made the constraints impossible. It was my own fault. But
vindicated as a writer. And that's tough for a writer because a writer of your stature, you're not affected. But some young writer could kill his career if he did that.
Oh, yeah. No, you can't do that.
Yeah,
Let's not kid yourself, folks. No. I only did it because I knew I didn't want to be on the project.
Right.
And they had the right guy waiting all along, Alvin Sargent, who wrote the second one and who had done some rewriting of the first one, who's a brilliant writer and is married to the producer. So it could all work out perfectly fine if they would just leave me alone. And it did, and they made a great movie, and that's cool. But the good experiences... I don't know if it's just because it just happened, but War of the Worlds was pretty good all the way through. Because you only have to deal with Spielberg when you, when you're working on one of his movies. There's no, nobody dares mess with him, so you deal directly with him.
And you worked with him twice before.
Yeah, and I knew him, and you know, and he trusted me, and so things were good. And Panic Room was really good because it was an original, and I sold it on spec. People tend to treat you better if they buy it on spec because they, you just come in with a little bit of moral authority. You know what I mean? Well, because you wrote it, and it was,
right.
And especially if more than one person wanted it, they're self-justifying. They feel like, well, we got into this competition and we got it, you know, so therefore we like it.
You have leverage.
Yeah.
And that's interesting. Now, for those of you who don't know, David moved from L.A. to New York in the late 90s. So Panic Room, you guys, I know, had gone through a renovation. Was that part of the...
Yeah, very much. We live in this townhouse three doors down from you, as you know.
And, we're not going to tell you what street.
Right. And but there's hints in all the movies. It's this townhouse, and we were remodeling it, and it took forever. And shit kept going wrong and going over budget, as remodelings do. And I was in the elevator one day. They had an elevator because I guess a guy who lived there used to be disabled and put an elevator in, and really slow old elevator. And I was taking some shit up to the top floor, and I was so angry at how much money this was costing and how long it was taking and how really inept everybody who was working was. I was so mad, and I thought, I'm going to make this fucking house pay for itself. I feel trapped in here. I'm going to write about it. So anyway,
you did.
Came up with that.
And it was successful. An interesting cast, too. What was it like working with David Fincher?
Fincher's great. He's really great. He's incredibly loyal to his writers, which is very cool. So he's intensely supportive of you.
Right.
But he on every movie, has to, I think, find somebody to demonize. Like, he's one of those guys who can only work if there's an enemy.
Right.
You know? So he'll pick an enemy, and it's usually someone in power. He doesn't pick somebody less powerful than him to be his enemy, which is good. But he'll decide the head of the studio is his sworn enemy. And you're like, well, they haven't really behaved that way. And he's like, nah, I'm going to fucking get them. And I don't know what the fuck they think they're doing. I'm like, well, they just approved your $5 million overage. Oh, fuck them, man. We got to get the fucking... You know, it gets him out of bed. So whatever works, you know.
Interesting cast, too. Were you ever considered as the director for the project? I read somewhere where I thought you were maybe pushing that agenda initially.
Briefly. But my kids were little, and it wasn't a good time to direct, so
right.
I didn't. At the beginning, I was thinking about. At the beginning, I didn't want to because it wasn't a good time to do it. Then I had a little trouble parting with the script, and I thought about it, but it was good. I didn't want to direct it.
Plus, you were in New York. You were shooting in New York.
Well, there would have been. The problem is there would have been no way to do it here because even though I set it here, I was dumb enough to make it all one location, which would be easily built on a soundstage in Canada or L.A. So I never would have got to shoot it here.
Right. What pushes your buttons when you sink into a project? The story, the plot, the characters, the arc of the characters, or the entire shebang?
Well, it's usually one of those, and it can vary from project to project. And then you pick up, hopefully, the other strands come together and come up to the level of thinking that you originally gave that one element. Sometimes they never do. Sometimes you go in with a premise and the characters never come up to that level, or you go in with characters and the premise doesn't quite follow as strongly. It's just, you never know what catches your attention, you know. It's always there's a 48-hour test, you know. You have an idea or you hear an idea or read something, and you can get very excited about making a movie out of that for 48 hours, and then it dies. Like, 2 days ago, I was really excited about, I wanted to write a movie about a guy who's having trouble in his life, and he goes to a therapist and gets some advice, and he goes and acts on the advice, and it just fucks everything up beyond belief, so he sues his therapist. And for 2 days, I was like, that's the movie I gotta do, and now it's dead. I can't think of anything else.
Well, there's an idea. Yeah. There's an idea for a writer out there.
Yeah.
How about with War of the Worlds? What was it? Was it the history and, you know, the H.G. Wells story plus... You know, the stunt in 1938.
Well, with that, it was... I was actually worried. My first impulse when Spielberg said, what do you think of War of the Worlds? I thought, well, I remember it's a great book, and I like the radio show, and I like the movie, and I like Jeff Wayne's musical version. You know, there's been great incarnations of it. But there's been so, it's two genres, you know, it's alien movies and it's a disaster movie. And those are so well trod. You know, we've seen so many movies in both those genres. How would we possibly avoid all the cliches? Because, you know, you want to do something of your own. But then when I reread the book, what I forgot was that nobody had used what I thought was the best idea in the book, which is to tell this huge global story from a really narrow perspective of one guy on the periphery.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and the book, except for this one section in the middle where he talks about his brother's adventures in London, which has most of the disaster movie cliches in it that have been pilfered over the years from the book. Not naming any names in particular, but Independence Day pops to mind.
I was thinking the same thing.
Yeah, they kind of stole, but it's public domain, so what are you going to do? Right. But I thought if we can create a character who's interesting enough and we only see what he sees, and the rule is we only see what he sees and we only know what he knows, then we might have a really claustrophobic movie about vast world events. And claustrophobia I really like.
Now, last night you went to the premiere. You had not seen a cut of the movie prior to this. Is that correct?
No, I did. I saw it once. I saw it about 3 weeks ago.
So, because you said Spielberg is very controlling when it comes to allowing people to see the work in progress and dailies and everything like that.
Dailies he's fine with. It, you know, if you're on the movie,
okay,
he won't let anybody else see it. But and then he'll show me a couple scenes if he likes them. He'll edited scenes.
Right.
But then a cut of the movie, he just can't make himself do it. You know what I mean? Like,
right.
I'll say, hey, I'm going to be in L.A. I'd love to see the movie if there's a cut. And he'll say, oh, yeah, sure, that'd be great. Let me call you back. You know, and never calls you back. And you call and go, okay, I'm in L.A. How about that cut of the movie? And he's like, oh, you know what? We just took it apart. It's all over the floor. With it. You know, there's nothing we can do. Next time, I'm definitely going to show it to you. And you're like, just say no. I know you're not going to show it to me.
Do you feel that he captured the essence of what you were trying to capture as the writer in the project?
Yeah, and then some. I mean, he's really, you see the first 10 minutes of the movie and you think, you know, is this guy just going to keep getting better? I mean, he's really, like, for visual storytelling, simple shots are so good.
Right.
He's really, really good.
I mean, he's one of the best, and specifically to the genre. I mean, Close Encounters and I don't know, it has
obvious parallels with Close Encounters or E.T., but I think its closer cousin is probably Jurassic Park. It's it's a big summer popcorn movie with incredible, you know, achievements in effects. I mean, these tripods are like not to be believed how good they are. And it's, I think it's his first sort of straight popcorn movie in about 10 years.
Wow. Now, he and Lucas are going to collaborate, right, on another Raiders of the Lost Ark?
So they say, but, you know, talk about Lucy with the football. I mean, I'll buy that when I see it. They say they have a script. What happens is they keep trying to get a script, and they can get two of the three of them, because Harrison Ford has to approve also. Two of the three of them can approve at any time,
right?
But never three of the three, you know?
Oh, no.
So, like, Steven and Harrison will love it, and George hates it.
So that's not a project you want to write?
Probably not. I kind of wanted to, but I just don't. I mean, there have been three, and the first one's just one of the best adventure movies ever made. I think it's better not to try and follow in those footprints.
Getting back to Spielberg. And directors in general, you know, is he a demanding director when you're on the set? Is there a lot of rewriting going on during the filming, or is it pretty much finished before you start shooting?
Pretty much finished. The ideas never stop coming, though. So it's not so much rewriting as adding stuff that strikes him. The first couple weeks, you know, the script's still settling into place and the actors are settling into the roles, and you're seeing who works and can be expanded and who might not work as well and needs to be trimmed a little bit. And I mean, not as an actor necessarily, although that happens, but as a character. But then after 3 or 4 weeks, it pretty much calms down.
How about working with De Palma? What's he like as a director and writing in the writing process?
It's great. I've done 3 movies for him and 3 for Steven. They're completely different human beings, but,
And different movies too.
Oh,
different
God,
themes.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah. Well, Light and Dark leaps to mind.
Right,
you know.
Right.
The But Brian's great. You know, also very encouraging and supportive of his writers. Doesn't fire them. You know, he's what's funny is by the time of the third movie, Brian and I agreed that I just wasn't going to go to the set because
what movie was that?
Snake Eyes was the third one.
Carlito's Way was the first.
Mm-hmm. Carlito's Way, Mission Impossible.
Mission Impossible, and right.
And
Snake Eyes is with Nicolas Cage. And I'm sorry, I didn't see it.
That's okay. First half works really well, and then we kind of screwed the pooch on the second half. But the Brian's a hermit, you know, and he lives so much in his head, and sometimes it's hard to pry that out, especially when he's shooting. So we would have I would go to the set because I thought he wanted me to, and it would always be backwards from whatever I saw because for some reason he would just have the mirror of what I saw in my head. Which is not better or worse. It's just backwards.
Right.
So apparently I would sit in a chair and wince, which he didn't find encouraging, you know. So I said, do you want me here? And he said, no. And I said, well, I don't want to be here, so can I go home? Absolutely.
Wow.
So.
What do you read for pleasure?
A little of everything, you know, inflammatory leftist propaganda when it's an election season. Op-eds I already agree with, you know.
You read The Onion? Do you like, you know, like The Underground and The Subversive, like, you know?
It's very funny, but I have to check in and out of The Onion because, you know, you get the tone after a while and
right.
You got to sort of go away for a little while to make it funny again. You know, novels, I try to read new stuff.
But when you're reading, are you reading just, I mean, like, if you were going to read something for pleasure and not, or any time you read, you could obviously think, hey, wait, I could adapt this into a movie, or?
Yeah.
It must be tough for you because,
you know. Well, it's hard to turn that off.
Right.
And that really does hinder your enjoyment of a book.
Right.
I like to, you know, there's stuff I read because I think it's good for me and I should learn this or I should, you know, I should work on this. Or there's, if I really just want to turn my mind on low, I like to read either some nonfiction crap about Hollywood, which I always find amusing, or somebody like Nelson DeMille, who, you know, I think is like that. If you're going to lay on the beach and read a book, read one of those guys who are really underrated storytellers. I mean, there's a reason they sell jillions of books, you know, and the characters may be hopelessly corny.
Right.
But I don't know. I just, that feels like a sorbet, you know. Because your mind needs a little vacation, too.
Yeah, sure, man. Did you cop to the Dan Brown books at all? Angels and Demons?
I only read Da Vinci Code because I was shooting a movie at the time, and I was sick of everybody around me talking about it and not knowing what they were talking
right.
about. So I read it on the set while I was shooting, which slowed us down for a few days.
What movie?
It was Secret Window.
Okay.
And but, you know, in between setups, you have time as a director, and it's not bad, but it made, apparently I was stalling one day because I was at a really good point,
right?
And the DP told a funny story about John Huston.
Mm-hmm.
That he on some movie, I don't know what, John Huston was reading some you know, some trashy novel that he had no business reading, and he had, like, they were setting up this very long tracking shot which took like an hour to lay all the track and stuff, but he only had about, and they said, Mr. Huston, we're ready. And but he only had like 30 pages to go in this book, and he really wanted to find out, you know, who did it or, right. you know, something like that. And he walked over to where the track was, and he said, I'm sorry, I misled you. The track should be over here. and made them lay, you know, relay the whole shot so he could finish his book.
That's good. I like that. That's good. When you read Da Vinci Code, didn't it read like a script? Because if you know,
oh, yeah.
I read Angels and Demons, and I go, "That's pretty good writing." Then I read Da Vinci Code, I go, "This guy's he's going for the payday here." You know, who can blame him? Because he was semi-successful, but you read the book and you just go, "Okay, who's going to be who's going to be the star?" And,
right?
You know,
I think his heart was totally in it. I mean, I think it's sincere. It just he happened upon, you know, a very popular and accessible concept.
Right.
What's weird is when you go to adapt them, and you'd have to ask Akiva Goldsman, who wrote the script for that movie, but the ones that read like a script, and you say, "Oh, this is all the action's very external,
right?
You know, it's very physical. There's lots to do." Those are always the worst, for some reason, the books that seem best suited to movies, just you have a nightmare time turning them into a movie.
Is it because you don't really know what to cut because they are written that way? So you're faced with a paramount task of like, wow, this is a really big story. It's written in a narrative, in a film style. What are you going to cut out and not piss somebody off?
Yeah. It's two reasons. It's one, because they're usually 300 or 400 pages long and their plots are intricate because the plot is foregrounded. And disentangling that into something that you can tell in 120 pages is just like, it's got to be like, you know, rewiring your computer. I mean, it's just so hopelessly complicated. And the second reason is because the characters are usually not as deeply thought in that kind of book as they are in some other books. And so you end up, you've got this big intricate plot, which you have already a space challenge about.
Right.
And you need to flesh out the characters, which you need space for, and may not necessarily work with the plot as you've got it. So it's really hard. Sometimes the best books into movies are the books that have really vivid characters and are underplotted, because you can always think of incident.
And they're short stories.
Yeah, well, novellas actually work.
Novellas,
great.
I was thinking. Yeah,
because
yeah.
They're about the right length.
100 pages, and you're in and out.
That's
and,
perfect.
Yeah. Well, actually, Secret Window was a short story. A lot of people, I don't know. Know that.
Yeah,
it was almost novella form, though, because it was at least 100 pages.
I think it was 140.
All right.
Yeah.
You can catch part two of my interview with screenplay writer David Kep next week. This is Dusty Wright for The Culture Catch.